I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Everyone, it's Raghu, back with Mind Rolling, and happy to introduce this wonderful podcast I did with Neil Allen. He just put a book together called Shapes of Truth, and we had a wonderful discussion on all sorts of different topics, compassion and dealing with stuff, suffering, and how he's just so honest in this book. It's really, really great to be able to be with somebody who has that kind of humility. And we talked about steadfastness and the need to grow up. That's a whole other thing. And what else did we talk about? Discrimination, which I talk about all the time. Viveka is incredibly important, especially, I think, for people on the bhakti path. That's why we were given so much direction without any direction to get into Buddhism through Vipassana meditation and some of the Tibetan practices. Some of us became close to many different Tibetan lamas and His Holiness the Dalai Lama himself. So yeah, Viveka is very important. So yeah, Neil and I had a really good time. I always have a good time. When I've met Neil before. He's married to Annie Lamott, Anne Lamott, and I've done a lot of stuff with her, and we've spent time together, and they just got married a couple of years ago. And so it was a real joy. That's all I got to say. It was a real joy, and I think you'll appreciate it. And I want to just say before we play the podcast that I did with Neil, we have a wonderful new partner named BetterHelp, and that's betterhelp.com. And they are an online therapy platform. And as difficult as it is these days to even get to see a therapist in any relatively, you know, like, hey, I got a problem now. I can't wait a half a year to get an appointment with you. So these people at BetterHelp have really done the right thing, and they match you based on conversation or forms that are filled out with a licensed professional therapist, and it's in a safe and private environment. And here's the big thing. I love who this is great copy for the sponsor commercial. Without ever having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room again. I don't ever want to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room again. I just did it today, actually. Not therapy, but for a doctor. And so and some of these doctors, they are providing service, either through phone call or Zoom or something. So things are changing. But this BetterHelp, they put it together right. So, and this is worldwide. It's affordable. It's convenient. It's everything one would want to be able to sit and talk through the stress all of us are having in one way or the other these days. And as a listener, you're going to get 10% off the first month, but you got to go to BetterHelp. That's HELP.com/mindrolling. And then you'll get that 10% and try it out. It's worth it. Again, given the proclivities of life as it is right now. So this episode, as I said, is with Neil Allen, and I will be back next week on Mind Rolling. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com, and there's Mind Rolling, there's Ram Dass Here and Now, there's Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, all of our old friends, and many, many, many more, including the new Alan Watts stuff we got going. We shall see you next week. Namaste. Hi, everyone. Raghu, I'm back. It is Raghu here with Neil Allen, is a relatively new friend, but as time goes on, he's starting to be an old friend because we haven't seen each other, obviously, in the pandemic. And Neil, welcome.
Hi, Raghu. Let's get this out of the way. I met Raghu through my wife, the author Anne Lamott, who got absorbed, despite her Jesus-y background, into the Ram Dass community as a fellow traveler. And oddly enough, I had more of the experience with Eastern religion than she did. And so I've been happily absorbed also.
Oh, that's great. And as I told her from the get-go, as far as Christ is concerned, when I went to India and first met Neem Karoli Baba, that was the first thing he talked about. So it wasn't about all the Hindu gods and goddesses. It was, I mean, except for Hanuman. He said Hanuman and Christ are the same. Right. Service to mankind, love, unconditionality.
And so, I believe he also scolded you guys for traveling so far to a distant land and distant religion rather than just sticking around with good old Jesus.
No, never happened at all. He never did anything like that. Well, there was nothing rational going on in terms of the way he related with us or anybody. But no, he never said that, ever. You know what he said, though? He would say, there would be a bunch of Indian devotees around and us, and he'd tell the translator to tell us what he's saying to them, which was, these people came all the way from America because of wanting spirituality, however he said that. You people, all you want is material bullshit, okay? I'm going to give them the keys to the universe. You get nothing. That's what he said. So, all right, well, I'd love to hear a little bit about how, and this is my central opening for a new guest, anyhow, on the podcast. And I always, what are the triggers that brought you to the place where you realized, geez, what they've been feeding us here, society, family, all of it, is maybe not real. It's not the thing, and it's not going to make me happy. And yeah, what are those events and triggers and just causes and conditions that created you now?
Yeah, there were a few very distinct episodes that happened quite clearly to me. I had been an atheist and a rationalist, happy, not disappointed by life, didn't find myself particularly yearning for purpose or greater meaning. I was pretty content. And then I read, at the urging of a very wise man named Bob Birnbaum, I read A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle.
Oh, yeah.
And he let me know that I was suffering much more than I had noticed, and that in very, very plain language, he really presented a fairly neo-Buddhist view of the world without any of the jargon, without any of the sense that he was talking about anything that wasn't already familiar to me, or that I had to learn something or learn a new vocabulary or whatever. And all that happened was I went, holy cow, I suffer. And that kind of sat with me. And I wondered, you know, this feels different. I don't know quite what to do about it. It seems intriguing, but I'm perfectly fine in the rationalist world, and maybe just everybody suffers, and that's fine. Well, soon after that, by just complete chance, a friend of mine invited me to sit with Adyashanti.
Oh.
And for those of you who know Adyashanti, you already know that his purpose in the world is to awaken people to the possibility of awakening. He's a fire starter. And that's what he does, and that's what he did for me. I was sitting in my first ever, well, first in 40 years. I think I'd meditated once with Allen Ginsberg in college, right? But since then, I had never done any meditation, never sat in a room with my eyes closed, surrounded by other people, which is a very weird thing to do. Right? The first 100 times you do it, and it's uncomfortable and strange and not thrilling at all. But something thrilling happened. I had a miraculous experience, and it was a very mundane, miraculous experience of believing that Adyashanti had been scanning the room while our eyes were all closed, and that he had come to me and he had pulled my soul out of me, looked at it, and then returned it to me. And I don't believe that actually happened. I don't believe Adyashanti actually did that. But at the time, I knew it had happened. And at the time, I knew a miracle had been performed. And at the time, I also knew that the symbolism of the miracle, there were symbols in it. It was like a gray, smoky dragon breath, my soul. So it couldn't have, my soul's not gray dragon breath, but there was some, I knew that the symbolism of whatever the vision that accompanied the miracle was of trivial importance, that the only thing that was important was that a miracle had been performed, which told me that there was a supernatural that I didn't know anything about, and that might be interesting to be explored. And that just set me off into an exploration. I think of it this way, that the first noble truth, all life is suffering, came to me from Eckhart Tolle. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering is attachment, had come to me, I guess I left this out, from Bob Birnbaum. We were actually doing identity clearing work. And so I knew something about it before. The third noble truth was Adyashanti saying, there is a way. And then the fourth noble truth, I stumbled through Bob Birnbaum and his wife, Evelyn. I stumbled into mystery school called Diamond Heart that the Hamid Ali creates through his explorations. And he's known to some of the listeners as by his pen name. He writes voluminously and frequently under the name A.H. Almas.
Yeah.
So that took me in, and then I spent, often on, I think I spent about 6 out of the next 10 years in twice a year retreats, 8-day retreats with Hamid and other teachers who he had trained in the same explorations.
Oh, and I never knew this till I got the book. By the way, Neil has a wonderful new book. It's fairly new. It's Shapes of Truth, Discover God Inside of You. And I did not know of your not just familiarity, but your deep involvement with the diamond method, yeah. Which I don't know much about. So I'd love to have you elucidate a little bit on that. But there was, of course, we have a friend who was one of Ram Dass's caretakers, who now is the only reason I know of the diamond effect is through him. And he is now with Hamid and his wife in Berkeley. So it's kind of part of the family in a funny kind of way. Yeah. But maybe...
You also know Jack Kornfield, who has considered Hamid a teacher of his for 35 years.
Mm. And Jack's never did I hear him ever mention the diamond pathway. Mm-hmm. So I just have not come really close to it. And so this was a little bit of a nice reveal. And why don't you just, how about talking a little bit about the central idea of this teaching?
Yeah, Diamond Heart is a brainchild. It is a result of a very curious and explorer, this guy Hamid Ali, who encountered, sometime 40, 45 years ago, encountered presence in the way a lot of us encounter presence, that suddenly after doing some meditation for a while or after chanting for a while or whatever, there's a noticing of a kind of smooth field, and there's something oddly satisfying about the field. And for a lot of us, that's our first kind of glimpse of a feeling called being in the moment or being present that doesn't seem to have very many needs or desires in it. And he was, instead of just kind of abiding in presence and trying to extend it and trying to continue in it in the way that he had met it, he actually went intentionally into it with a couple of friends, and they wanted to explore whether there were mechanics to it, whether there was a way of knowing how it happens, how to appreciate it. They were basically saying, I don't believe that there is an ineffable out there. Mm. I think even this mysterious thing called presence probably does something, has something, comes from somewhere in a very familiar way, and exists in a particular way that can be explored. And so he started exploring it. The more he explored it, the more he noticed that what got in the way of his being able to explore it was his defensive system. And he had done some psychological work. He had done some work with, I think Claudio Naranjo. So he had some Gurdjieffian training and some Enneagram training. And so all of that kind of put him in the mood that, modern psychology, contemporary psychology has belongs within a faith system and belongs within a system of discovering a deeper reality. Eventually, through a kind of dialectic method with his two partners and then finally later one partner of just exploring what is, he became a guy who I look at him as the William James of spirituality, where William James described the varieties of religious experience. Yeah. Hamid, in his books and his explorations, is cataloging in great detail the experiences of spirituality. And he's finding cognates in his experiences with things that can be found in Buddhism and in Vedanta work and in Shaivism and in shamanism. And he goes in all these different places, very, you know, extremely eclectic. But what he keeps coming back down to is a necessity to keep an eye on and to find ways to remove the obstacles of the ego, which are our defenses. And so not only is he studying spiritual methods and seeing what they're about, but he's also studying basic contemporary psychology. And he kind of settled on object relations theory, a standard view in the, kind of the standard model of contemporary psychology of looking at the development of the ego. And he noticed things in object relations theory that look kind of like a series of shields being being brought up by people as they develop from birth through, you know, 10 years old, 12 years old. And he started playing around with it and found ways to deconstruct the shields in reverse order so that you could go back in your, as if you're devolving back to that kind of pure dual unity that you came out of, and then see whether you can live as a mature person. So he does something that eliminates the possibility of spiritual bypass. It forces people to work closely with their inner psychological demons, and most of that work opens most of the illuminated world.
I like that image, though, the shield image. Yeah. It's like dominoes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's very mechanical.
Pop one of them and...
Yeah.
I love that image. Yeah.
I tend to think that he's very efficient at... In the end, his program, I really benefited from it, and I watch other people benefit from it, that it provides a very concrete, efficient way to remove the obstacles of the ego. And he uses his 5,000, at any one time, he's got 5,000 or so followers who are involved in this progressive method. And he watches those groups, and they're his guinea pigs to see what actually works to get the obstacles of the ego out of the way and let the light in.
Right. Can you give an example of something that he would suggest into a concrete obfuscation?
Yeah.
Obfuscation.
So the first thing that happens is that you have to get used to the fact that you're going to be tortured. And so whatever is bugging you right now, you know, my kids don't appreciate me, right? Or my boss is a jerk, or I'm just no good at math, or whatever it is that's been bugging you for the last couple of days, some little pesky thing. Go look at it and go just look at it over and over and over and over and over again, and don't avoid it and torture yourself with it. And at the end of torturing yourself with it, maybe it'll move out of the way a little bit. And that's kind of what you do over and over again. So I do a kind of offshoot from Diamond Heart. I'm not a Diamond Heart teacher. I'm not in the mystery school anymore. I just picked up some mechanical notions from it.
Yeah.
But I start every one of my sessions with a client by asking a series of three questions over and over again. So I ask one question for 5 minutes over and over again. So I'll do it with you and show people what it's like. Tell me something, first of all, that's been bugging you lately.
Who, me?
Nothing.
I'm just clear all time. Okay,
right.
What's been bugging me lately? God, you know, it's a long list, but
Let's start with probably the top thing that's been has been a thorn in the saddle, so to speak, is recently being informed one has to move from the property that I and we are on, and that has created a lot of anxiety around the pandemic, around what's going on in this particular area, around real estate, you know, so that very survival kind of a deal has come up. Not, I'm not concerned that, though obviously I will be taken care of by virtue of I have enough trust in the universe for the knowing the right thing will happen, but that low level kind of anxiety because it's not quite there yet, and you know you're just pondering its weight in terms of wow, that's still
is going to be confronting
me after all these years of spiritual work, you know, all that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to ask you, we won't do it for the full 5 minutes, but I'll ask you for a minute. Mm. Tell me a way you wish for stability in your life.
Well, stability to me is only one thing.
Thank you. Tell me a way you wish for stability in your life.
To be even more aligned with that me that is not, that is beyond the desire and attachment realm.
Thank you.
To be aligned behind that.
Thank you. Tell me a way you desire stability in your life. And you can go back in your life to your childhood, or you can be talking about your being disrupted by this move or anything. Tell me a way you desire stability in your life.
That what's important to me for stability is to continue the kind of work that I have been doing for many, many, many years, and at the same time to release the attachment to that identity.
Thank you. Tell me a way you desire stability in your life.
To transform the neurotic tendencies and habitual patterns that were created, especially around a as a child.
Thank you. Tell me a way you desire stability.
Well, I honestly, I cannot. If I get those things, Neil, I would be, as they say at the high holidays for Jewish people, that would have been sufficient. I can't think of anything else that would create stability that I believe in, shall we say.
Like, I'm not saying what do you believe in. Tell me a way you desire stability.
Well, I mean, that means anything to me. It has to be a thing that I really believe would help make my life more stable. And for instance, one thing I don't believe is that more money, more material, anything is going to make my life. So that's...
Okay. So that's how I start. I ask, and it's a repeating question. Then I ask a second question, what's right about stability? Which allows the person to hear the motivating desire for stability, right? If that's the issue, right? Or if the issue is control, or the issue is being seen, or the issue is being right, I'll get those motivating voices out into the air. And those two questions, by focusing on them for, you know, 10 minutes, you're focusing on what's bugging you for 10 minutes. And most people don't focus on what's bugging them for more than 20 seconds, right? You either want to fix it, deny it, or avoid it. You're not going to focus on it. And you're going to find a way to move into a preferable state of being to the one of being, of noticing that you're suffering. So essentially all Hamid ever does is put right in front of my face my suffering.
The torture part, though, is a little gee. Remember you said the central thing is torture.
It is torture. It's torture at first, until ultimately it becomes kind of fun to, oh, I got that room to clean up. I thought I had cleaned that room up 2 years ago. It's got a, there's a corner that needs to be swept out. Great. If I torture myself, it'll get swept out, and that won't be afflicting me for the next few months.
I guess I just can't. I can't. I don't jive with the word torture related to the kind of spiritual work that we're talking about. It puts a tone and a color to it that's, I can't get there. I think that, I personally prefer the Buddhist, which a lot of this is completely aligned with, and that much I know. But, you know, just around mindfulness. So the actions that you take, you are developing enough awareness so that you can see the motivations behind the things that are causing this deep suffering. And I guess we're talking about the same thing, but using the word, you're relentless, maybe. Relentlessly, you are going to have that in front of your face till you really get to some kind of truth about your motivations.
Because the motivations are the illusion, right? We think the illusion is the suffering. We think the illusion is the attachment, right? The motivation is the illusion. The motivation is a voice in our head that belittles us, right? Freud called it the superego. Most people call it the inner critic. It's what establishes our defensive systems that get in the way of accepting the world as it is. And it is torture to spend time with that belittling voice, right? That belittling voice is snarky, it's mean. And if I keep it invisible and keep it out of the way, I'm going to keep it strong. But if I bring it out to the surface, it's like a vampire. It'll disintegrate all on its own. In the end, most of what I learned from Diamond Approach, I think, was that all I have to do is spend all my time in the screwed up defenses that I have established for myself. And simply by spending my time watching them in operation and questioning their assumptions and motivations, all the good stuff will show up. I don't have to point myself ever to the good stuff. I don't have to point myself to nirvana. I don't have to fake it till I make it. I don't have to do anything except remove my defensive systems, and nirvana just pours in.
True. All true. That's the beauty of all these, right? All these paths, they lead to the same exact place. Just whatever your predilection is, and that's about it, right?
Yeah. I'm kind of I'm odd to be in a, I'm probably as far removed from a bhakti kind of person as you'll meet, right? I have zero sense of devotional practice. I love kirtan. I love being around devotional sittings. I love all of it. I'm not saying I don't appreciate or love it or feel it or care that it exists in the world. It just doesn't happen to be my path. My path is this torture, right?
I'm sorry.
No, it's funny.
There should be a URL associated. Neil Allen / torture.
Yeah,
I bet you will get a big following.
You know, no. What's funny about it is I call it torture, and I tell all my clients I torture you, right? And none of them, so far, has said, "Wow, I didn't like that," right?
Okay.
None of them. So whatever kind of torture it is, it it seems to come with the built into it. It turns out we're really good at looking at our own suffering. We don't think we are. You know, think about what most conversation is. It's complaining. Most people are complaining all day long, right? Why do they do that? Because when you release the complaint, the thing that you're complaining about disappears for a moment.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Especially as you age.
God, the physical complaints.
Actually, when we were kids in India in our early 20s, all that was going on was this complaining about health. Okay, because we were in India where, you know, we weren't used to the bugs and stuff that they had over there, so they got us good. Oh boy,
it isolates you into your cot and your head, you know. So I can see how, as a 20-year-old, I could have benefited from being sick a little more often. I wouldn't have been able to go out and enjoy the sensual world quite as much, get quite as attached to it.
Yeah, we managed, let me tell you. We managed. Oh, boy. Oh, you know, I was thinking about the miracle. And you said, I don't believe that. And by the way, everybody, I talk about Adya from time to time, Adya Shanti. He's a great teacher, and I had a chat with him. And this is my favorite story in the whole world. As he grew up, wondering what in the hell was going on with the people around him, he was a little kid, you know, he couldn't understand. You know, they're getting wasted, they're angry, they're laughing without, you know, whatever. It was all crazy to him. And he finally figured it out when he was 10, 11, 12 or something. And he looked at them and he got it. Oh, my God, they believe their thoughts. That's what's going on. He told me that. And that led him to meditation. And he did that for 10 years. Like for, as a youngster, teenager, until he got to the point where nothing was happening. So he quit. And when he quit, he had some real space opened up to him. And he became who he is.
He also sat in a cafe every day and wrote about what the illusion of reality looked like to him. And through that, he did a lot of his emotional psychological work day after day after day after day. So you can, you know, I think the guy who writes as Jed McKenna, do you know those books?
No.
Crazy books. What's that? They're very funny. It's a he wrote a book called Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing. He kind of skewers he's kind of sarcastic and skewers a lot of spiritual practices or as they're talked about and exhibited but seems to be the real thing.
What's his name? Again.
Well, he calls himself Jed McKenna. He's very, very careful to conceal who he is. Really? He has no desire to be
get
out
on
in
a
the
podcast.
World.
Huh?
Yeah, no, it's too bad. I think actually people have traced him to your old stomping grounds, North Carolina.
Oh, really?
Somewhere. Yeah,
get out, but, detectives.
Yeah, there are people who do that, but
sounds like he. In a way, it's a great thing that busts spiritual bypass, right?
It totally busts spiritual bypass. But his method was like Adya's. He calls it autolytic writing. It's just kind of pouring out, among other things, your grievances, right? And as you start to do that, the assumptions that you start to see the repetitive circular assumptions, you know. Oh, I don't have enough friends. Why don't I have enough friends? I need more friends. Why do I need more friends? Because you need more friends, right? Yeah. And everybody's got that, right? No matter how many friends they have, they need one more or something, right? Who's telling them that? Well, it turns out we've got a little inner critic voice in us that tells us that. It's very useful for the species to be very, very productive and expand into new niches and grow in population, but it's not very useful for enjoying the commonality of being beautiful, compassionate beings living in a difficult and absurdly complicated world.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk. Actually, you have a great story. It's in your chapter on compassion. Where you went back to school to learn Sanskrit. Can you want to tell that story? It's it's very honest of you to reveal it all, talk about you got into the torture thing there for sure.
Yeah, I did. Do you mind if I read it?
No.
Okay, no. I'll read it. Our first year of marriage was pretty easygoing. Annie and I met late in life, and each of us had built up some skills in curing or bypassing a lot of the usual conflicts. Put another way, life had beaten us down enough that we knew not to provoke another lashing. It's not that money and jealousy were no longer treacherous, but a little eye rolling behind the other person's back was sufficient to get through the day. When the pandemic showed up, we adjusted pretty quickly and blessed ourselves for already having such routine, boring lives. And then I made the mistake of going back to school. It wasn't just the Sanskrit. The other classes too quickly wore me down. Is this the chapter you want me to write about?
Yeah. This is the story where you get into your own self-criticism big time and
dealing with the habitual pattern. Got it. The problem was that I didn't know how to shut up, and all the classes were seminars. No lectures, just open discussions where anyone, especially me, could poke their nose in. Never invite a congenital know-it-all to an open conversation. After every class, I turned off the Zoom feed and limped from my office to the living room, where Annie would look up cheerfully and ask, "Talk too much?" Sometimes I muttered back, "I hate myself." Or I just stared at my kind wife, slack-jawed, while my mind played back the Grateful Dead lyric, "Please don't dominate the rap, Jack, when you got nothing new to say," over and over. I tried the usual cures, pre-class admonishments to speak no more than four times, file cards on which I ticked off each time I spoke. Nine was the fewest, more than two times my self-imposed quota, under the breath self-thrashings. I started waking up in the middle of the night, upset at myself. Finally, I asked Annie for help. Her response? "Tell me more." She didn't offer a cure or an explanation. She left all that to me. She did ask me questions and encouraged me to talk about it. Slowly, I started to uncover, again, both the genesis of my narcissism, which has something to do with being brought up in a know-it-all household, and the triggering aspects of being back in school, where I'm to be judged and graded on my intelligence. Ugh. I disliked thinking about this even more than I dislike beets. But Annie didn't let go. "Tell me more," she said, day after day. And eventually, simply by revealing my suffering to Annie and therefore to myself, I didn't hate myself like I was the pariah student. I moderately disliked myself like I was beets. That was enough. I could even feel sorry for myself. And while my over-talking continued to be fixed the following semester, perhaps, my self-loathing released itself into the ether. What Annie had shown me, and what with her tutelage I started to feel for myself, is the aspect of God known as compassion. Mm.
I love this. I mean, we all have that story. It's just got a different color and a different theme, maybe. But... to me, that's the essence of everything. To begin with, we have to begin with that compassion for ourselves. We have no chance of having it for anybody else. And it's a work in progress. So it doesn't mean you stop relating in any way or stop doing activities or stop going to school or whatever it is that triggers you. You have to realize that you are working. And this allows you to continue that work, even though it's a bit of what you would call torture.
Yeah. Yeah, the flip side of torture is, I've been reading some Dogen lately, it's central to Zen Buddhism that the practice is the attainment.
Yeah.
There is never not practice, because there's always a shiny object. And no matter what assumptions I've disrupted and removed from myself, so I won't get attached in one way, another way to be attached will pop up. And
for sure,
I get to either go, oh, not that again, or, oh, cool, I get to do this again, right? Mm. I get mm-hmm. to do it again. I get mm. to do it again. I get to move past attachment again. Mm. Yeah, sure, maybe there are times to move past attachment and stay put in not a state of being, but in some kind of freewheeling liberty, right? And then attachment will return.
Yeah. Good perspective. And by the way, here, I just want to read this little thing from around your something that I just completely am at one with you on. Compassion is the love that arises in the presence of suffering. Compassion isn't manufactured. It arises all on its own. I'm not compassionate in the sense that it isn't something I do. It's more like a place where I find myself living. I find myself in the presence of compassion, or in the house of compassion.
God, it just sends a
that's well said.
Chill, but it sends a chill up my spine every time I notice it, right? Yeah. We are so lucky to live in a field of love. The world's rigged to love, to things like compassion and passion and giggly friendship, right? That's the way the world is rigged. It didn't have to be rigged that way. But if I remove my dumb defenses and get them out of the way, all that's left is love. And I get to live in this world.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, the central thing and what Hamid, as you described it very generally, but I think everybody has a good idea of how he suggests dealing with obscurations, basically. Just removing those shadows one by one. And as that happens, well, it's the old story of the onion skin.
Right? Yeah.
You keep peeling it. And again, all different kinds of metaphors for the same thing. But at the core, there has to be compassion, because if you're sitting around torturing yourself, thinking, being any kind of masochistic attachment there, you are done. There's no way. So
you know, that's a good point. Compassion is the field that you end up in, but it also can be an objectified notion that you can bring to bear on your work, so that the difficult work of moving through your defenses, of the torture of it, you can have compassion as a kind of complement that allows you to, and strength too, those two can help you along in a kind of very utilitarian fashion. And that's what the book is called, Shapes of Truth. It's about these kind of utilitarian objects that represent the ultimate aspects of God that can appear in your body, and usually they appear in that utilitarian way to either remind you that you're not the person you think you are, who has the disappointments that you think you have, or who has the need for achievements that you think you have. You're simpler than that, and you're more glorious than that. Mm. And each one of these little symbolic objects, which are actually kind of universal and can be found inside people, which is the stunning discovery, I think, that Hamid made, each one of them can be seen both as a ultimate field of God and a way of looking at an ultimate field of God that I might be part of or might not be part of, depending on how I look at it. And it can be a little tiny gem or stone or some kind of symbolic talisman to help you through a particular difficulty, a particular kind of difficulty. Now, there are only 35 of these things. And one way to think about it is that my emotional defenses develop 35 different rooms. And each of them needs its own little kind of work. So I have a room for my mom issues, and I have a room for my dad issues, and I have a room for my guilt, and I have a room for my hatred, and I have it, right? And there are different kinds of issues, but all of us have all of them, right? We just have our own flavor of which ones are stronger or weaker in this. We all have these issues. We all have the same issues. Everybody is defending themselves from the exact same crap.
Okay? Yep.
Yep. And that's just funny. And so the metaphor I found useful was, I use one of these objects and one of these aspects of God and one of these shapes that can be evoked in myself as part of focusing on a particular room of illusion that is a defensive system in my life. And illusion and defenses go hand in hand. And I'm just trying to clear out the clutter in that room. And I get to focus on that room this week. And then next week, my boss is a martinet becomes the room I have to focus on.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know how Ram Dass used to, I mean, we're talking about imagination here, I think, as well, right? Mm-hmm. And we're setting up these rooms in our imagination, and we're placing different themes and go back to them, and they're all there and just waiting to be dealt with and or tortured by whatever. And he had a thing about using imagination to connect with our guru, Neem Karoli Baba. And he used to, and you've been at the retreats, so I'm sure you've heard him say it. Yes, I have a room. It's my imagination room. And I go into that room and I talk to my guru. And people think I'm crazy. Mm-hmm. And in reality, that begins in my imagination and ends up in that, what he would call that core loving awareness place. And so I think it's useful, actually. This just points to me, it's useful to use these. And I love what all of what you're suggesting and this practice of Hamid, and that you're really dealing with the psychological stuff. A lot of the spiritual bypass really feels like, okay, we don't need to deal with that. We have transcended that. And, you know, that's a huge-ass problem for many people in spirituality, the way I have seen it. And so the dealing with it is the dealing with the psychological parts of yourself. And so this is a wonderful way, get these rooms in order, get them lined up. And it's good to work with somebody who has an idea and can guide, an idea about each of these themes, has gone through it themselves, and can guide one through it similarly that you would guide somebody through a psychedelic trip, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. These are, that's an interesting metaphor, yeah. I did psychedelics without guides, right? So I did.
Me too.
And so I don't know that much about using guidance. But the one thing about this is that throughout, there's always an assumption that I have that you have the answers for yourself, and that your answers are inside you just the way my answers are inside me. And I get away with that in a substantial way with my clients because of the universality of this, of these shapes that Hamid discovered. So that I can be as generic as is possible in how the kinds of things that I ask my clients during the portion in which we're doing the shapes work. And they will evoke ultimately these 35 objects. And about 10 of them just about everybody eventually evokes. Others are more subtle or less annoying, less prominent parts of our defensive system. So if I've got 35 rooms, 10 of them are the American culture rooms. 25 of them are
our rooms.
Yeah. And everybody in this culture worries that they're not productive enough. You know,
yeah,
everybody.
Right. Right? Top,
but there are cultures where that might be room 25.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the interesting part of it all. Oh, and I didn't finish what I was going to say about the miracle with Adyashanti. And when you said, now, do I believe that he came in and examined my soul, et cetera, et cetera? No, not really. But at the other hand, on the other hand, I do believe it happened. And my experience, my own personal experience around the same kind of a thing is very much, well, first of all, I had had my mind shut down by a being that was beyond duality. So there was no way you could start thinking back on yourself like that. So that was one helpful thing, to say the least. And the other thing was just the realization, absolutely, the universe is taking care of each one of us through, I do believe everyone has a guide deep inside them, or not so deep inside them, or that they connect with in a physical way in a lifetime is rare but possible, as happened to some of us. And at the same time, it's irrefutable that this happened to you, the fact that whatever his involvement with the universe is way beyond our pay grade, Adyashanti, but it's real. It's absolutely as real as the glasses on yours and my faces right now.
And somehow I needed that, right? That's the curious thing. Because I was an atheist, because I was a rationalist, because I had kind of demonized not inappropriately, what I had heard about the supernatural and what I had detected about it. It was absolutely necessary for it to have the sensation of being as real as my probably illusory sensation that this desk and table and TV are real.
No, absolutely. And you know what? Also referencing Ram Dass here, but and this you talk about a little bit about power in the book, and I using it in a little bit of a different reference than the one I'm making right now. But Ram Dass used to say that when he came back from India the first time, he was blown away by the power of such a being to know everything about him and know what was going to happen in the future, you know, and other physical miracles that he experienced. And we, by the way, all of us, this happened, and we all did the same thing as you did. I guess I needed that. Somehow I needed that because of just so deeply embedded in rationalism, maybe. I don't know. Everybody gets that some it could be just an acid trip that has that ineffable quality to it for a few minutes does that. And he said, but the thing is, I was completely enamored of the power through the miracles. But later I came to understand really what it was all about was the love.
Yeah. Well, Ram Dass embodied that in a way that's very unusual. You know, and so strikingly material his love that being in his presence in those last years was a way of noticing the possibility that pure love could negotiate the difficulty of the world without pause, and could be sustained, you know, and could be enough to carry on relationships, to carry on activities. And we generally don't believe that, right? We have to toughen up. We have to, you know, I don't, I've sat with a number of people who are described in the world as spiritual masters over the last 10 or 15 years. I was late to the table, but I've tried to make up for it, right? And the ones who seem to touch me, I notice are inevitably kind. Mm. And the second thing is, and I think this is more just astonishing, they seem to be both impossible to offend and right close to me. Mm. And to whoever's talking to them, whoever's around, they seem to be enjoying themselves, and nothing that that person could say or do would offend them. And I think that's those are good signs that somebody is has moved out of their defensive postures.
Yeah, yeah.
Into love.
Into love. But the best sign is, shit, maybe we have a chance. That's the best sign, right? They're humans, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I, just before we go, we're getting towards the end, but just when I said this whole thing from Ram Dass, he realized it was all about love. And you have a nice section in the book around that as well that I really appreciated. And talking about the transactional nature of love, that we have that hammered into us.
Yeah.
That is, to me, you're talking about all the different rooms to deal with.
Yeah.
The transactional love room is there, right?
Five rooms.
Yeah. You know, and that, oh, and I love, we could have the, what do you call it? Pink fluffy love room. We could have that, which is hammered in, especially to young women. You know.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I think the most embarrassing thing in life that I've run into from this practice or my moving into a little more freedom is to discover that my default appearance of love in the world is goofy and silly and just a kid on a bike, you know. And that if I had to find a core self who was relating to the world in his most natural and default way, it's probably a little kid. Just goofy and seamless and careless and unpatterned, but goofy. And that's embarrassing, right? I'm supposed to be a mature human being.
Wait a minute. Christ did say, unless you were a little guy, a little child, right? See the world that way. There's going to be an issue. So
It's funny if beginner mind includes goofiness, right?
Includes what?
Goofiness.
Yeah. My favorite Disney guy is Goofy. Goofy on sports. I love him. Oh, boy. And by the way, the other thing I wanted to mention is I had your wife on. We've done a number of podcasts and so on and done some good fun stuff together. And it's been a delight all these years. But the last time was this last book that she put out. And in it was quite outstandingly humorous encounters with her husband and going through the whole thing of getting to know someone and getting used to somebody and finding all of those lovely little triggers. And it, everybody else, what's the name of the book? I can't remember right
Dusk
now.
Dusk Night Dawn.
Okay. Alongside of, we're going to have Shapes of Truth in the show notes so you can find it easily. And we're going to have Dusk, Night, and Dawn. You do talk about, you know, how you met Annie and how, you know, some of the permutations, shall we say.
Well, Annie actually wrote the foreword in my book, and it's a beautiful, it's one of my favorite essays by her, but it's a beautiful essay about our first date.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, it is great. It is great. And you guys, since, you know, I spent time with you together, God is good. That's all I can say, right? That you found each other. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, it's pretty surprising. Yeah. She'll if she hears this, she'll get a kick out of my bringing it up. When she met me, I was toying with renunciation. And she said, I don't want a guy holding out a cup.
That's verboten.
I said, okay, I guess that won't go. I guess I'll stay in the material world.
A little longer, a little longer. Well, listen, you know, the story that you told about dealing with this past pattern of making yourself heard, in the way that she worked with you as a partner, that to me is what it's all about.
It is.
It's not, that is no longer, there's no transactional anything. That's just someone offering themselves in the way that's how it should be in a relationship in my eyes. Not that I've been the most successful myself, but I've learned a lot, and I feel like you expressed that, and she expressed it through that whole process.
Yeah, I'm lucky.
Yeah. Hey, great to have you here, Neil.
Great to see you. It's been too long, and actually, it's great to know you in a deeper way.
Right? Yeah,
so
that's what happens.
Dialectic, being able to talk about these sorts of things is, you know how if you talk about tripping, you start to feel yourself tripping, the body rushes show up. But it's true with anything spiritual, right? Yeah. Those body rushes are your life force after all. And so your life force shows up because you're talking about your life force, right? Yeah. And so it becomes amplified. And the same thing is true with any, interesting, fascinating, any fascination with what's beyond the immediate familiar world. Mm. I get to just feel turned on.
Yeah, I'm with you, which is why this particular job is so great. It happens every time I do a podcast. It's worth every inch of it all. It really is. And as Annie would tell us in Sunday school, Christ said, where two or more are gathered in my name, there I am. And that is so darn true. I mean, it is absolute truth. It's what our gathering, satsang, sangha, community, whatever. And as Thich Nhat Hanh said, the next Buddha is the sangha.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
We'll have to do this more time. We should do something with the both of you and go through. Maybe we shouldn't, but I thought, what a wonderful thing, going a little bit about relationships and how to navigate that and the successes and the failures that we should do. I just thought of
that. Yeah, as long as you're prepared for watching a nasty combat.
torture. Again, thank you. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and catch all of the fantastic podcasts that we have up there these days. And again, Neil, thank you. And thanks for Shapes of Truth. And we'll connect everybody up with that. Namaste.